tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Zbigniew Brzezinski, advisor to several American presidents and one of the most influential gurus in Washington, is the author of The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives. Brzezinski's 1997 book is said to have biblical authority among the George W. Bush gang and its endless war intelligentsia. In it, Brzezinski writes, "Ever since the continents started interacting politically some 500 years ago, Eurasia has been the center of world power. That controlling this vast area of the world ensures not only new sources of energy and mineral wealth, but a, quote, guard post over American control of the oil in the Persian Gulf. Nation states, says Brzezinski, will be incorporated into the new order. To put it in terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, he says, three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together." Quote, quote. Meanwhile, sea levels and temperatures are rising, and the global capitalist economy is staggering under the weight of its own corruption. As we shall hear in our first hour, the energy resources, especially oil, that Brzezinski's imperial strategy serves to protect will soon be gone. Political and business leaders, instead of facing the coming crisis and attempting to make provisions for the benefit of all while there is still time, are instead acting like pickpockets on a sinking ocean liner, grabbing what they can and heading for the lifeboats. Meanwhile, opposition is rising to the latest neoliberal trade treaty under the WTO that hopes to sweep away even the meager remaining benefits that governments provide to the average citizen. In the second hour, Wizards of Money returns with a look at the General Agreement on Trade in Services, GATS, and the growing worldwide resistance to it by civil society groups. Kelly Ramirez and Bonnie Faulkner are the producers of Guns and Butter, a radio program on the economics of politics in Berkeley, California. Late last year, they spoke with Professor Richard Heinberg about what has been called the Great Rollover.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Richard Heinberg is a core faculty member at New College of California, where he teaches courses on energy and society and culture, ecology, and sustainable community. He is also a journalist, a musician, and editor of the monthly newsletter, which was nominated in 1994 by Utney Reader for an Alternative Press Award. The newsletter has also been included in Utney's annual list of best alternative newsletters. Professor Heinberg is the author of several books, including Cloning the Buddha, The Moral Impact of Biotechnology. He is currently working on a book about the future of energy resources. Richard, in your article, Oil, War, and Terror, you refer to a phenomenon known as the Big Rollover. What is that?
The Big Rollover is a phrase that was coined by L.B. Magoon of the United States Geological Survey a couple of years ago, and it describes what other people have called the Hubbert Peak or the peak in world oil production. L. King Hubbert was a petroleum geologist who, back in the 1950s, predicted that U.S. oil production would peak around 1970. And at the time, in the 50s, when he made that prediction, it was just considered outrageous. Almost no one believed him. He made the prediction not on the basis of a crystal ball, but on the basis of his experience of how the geology of oil production functions. He saw again and again in oil field after oil field that when about half of the oil has been extracted from a given field, it becomes more and more difficult to continue production at the same level. And so typically what happens is when about half the oil has been extracted, that's when the rate of production or the rate of extraction of oil peaks, and from that point it tapers off. Well, he extrapolated that to North American oil production, and of course, the United States, historically, up to that time, had been the world's primary producer of oil. He extrapolated that to U.S. oil production, predicted a peak in 1970, and that was confirmed. U.S. oil production did, in fact, peak in 1970, and that's why we're importing about 40% of our oil, 40 or 46% of our oil today. Now, in more recent times, Magoon of the USGS and Colin Campbell and Kenneth DeFries and a number of other petroleum geologists have used Hubbert's calculation methods, have applied them to global oil production, and figures that almost all of them are coming up with is a global production peak sometime between roughly 2003 and 2010. 2010 is in the more optimistic side. So Magoon published this independently of the USGS. The U.S. Geological Survey came out with its official report last year, which said that the peak wouldn't come for at least another 20 years. But Magoon and most of the other petroleum geologists feel that this is primarily a political document. The USGS has been wildly optimistic. Previously, they were one of the big opponents of M. King Hubbert back in the 50s and 60s. And so the big rollover is really probably going to be the most important economic event of our lifetimes. Industrial civilization is built on fossil fuels. The whole thrust of the industrial civilization has been the replacement of human and animal and wood power with the power of fossil fuels. And the amount of energy that human beings have extracted from fossil fuels over the last 100 years, 150 years, is absolutely mind-boggling. Our whole American way of life is built on this amazing abundance of energy. Each and every American has, on average, an equivalent of about 150 energy slaves. In other words, if the amount of work done for each of us by fossil fuels each day had to be done by human beings, each of us would have to have 150 or 200 people working for us 24 hours a day. And, of course, these are unpaid slaves in this case because fossil fuels cost vanishingly little. A barrel of oil right now is going for less than $20. If the amount of energy in that barrel of oil were made equivalent to the human work in terms of the energy of human work and the people doing that work were paid only $5 an hour, a barrel of oil would be worth $40,000.
But Richard, this is Kelly Ramirez here. As you get below that 50% threshold, don't the costs of production go up? So wouldn't we be seeing the cost of energy rise as we get closer to this great rollover?
Well, actually, that's not necessarily the case. After the rollover, then prices will go up as a result of the discrepancy between demand and supply. But until the rollover actually takes place, price is determined by momentary supply and demand. That changes on the basis of global economy. If there's a recession, then demand is reduced. If Saudi Arabia gets in an oil war with Russia, as is actually happening right now, where Saudi Arabia is producing extra amounts in order to fend off Russia's bid to increase its share of global production, well, then that reduces price. We've seen the price of oil actually drop precipitously since the beginning of the Afghan war. And this is entirely due to market conditions. It has absolutely nothing to do with the amount of oil actually left in the ground. And this is one of the tragedies of the market economy. It tells us absolutely nothing about the status of real physical resources that we depend upon. The assumption of the economists is that if supply starts to dry up, that will drive up price, which in turn will stimulate more supply. But in the case of a physical resource like oil, once we start to exhaust it, then it doesn't really matter how many more wells are drilled. It doesn't matter how much more exploration takes place. Once we pass that peak, we will have a few percentage points less oil to go around each year, no matter what we do.
Richard, once we reach that rollover point globally, then the price is going to be more determined on scarcity and not just daily market. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
And I assume with the world population increasing all the time, that's going to put huge pressures on not only price, but, you know, the availability of energy.
Well, yes, it'll put huge pressure on the global economy. It's often said that energy is a smaller part of the economy, at least nationally for the U.S. now than it was in the 1970s, and that's true in dollar terms. But if you look at the economy from an ecological standpoint, from an energetic standpoint, all economic activity is tied to energy, transportation, agriculture, you name it. Without fossil fuels, we would really have to reorganize our entire way of life.
It sounds like we should be doing that already. But how can we do that if, for example, they estimate there's $4 trillion worth of oil in the Caspian Sea region? Where's the incentive to make the transformation, even though we can see this rollover coming?
The people who are responsible for making the decisions that could help us make the transition to a non-fossil fuel economy right now happen to be the same people who are profiting from the oil economy. We have what's often been termed an oiligarchy in Washington right now. George W. Bush and his cabinet are almost all former oil people and with very strong ties to the industry still. And even though the economics profession very largely has its head buried in the sand with regard to the impending peak in world oil production, it looks as though the Bush administration is quite aware of this. They have plenty of friends who are oil geologists, and one of them, Matthew Simmons, has been saying for many years that this peak is coming. I think that they're well aware of this, and the present war in Central Asia probably has a great deal to do with that.
Could you name some of the figures in the administration and their ties to oil?
Well, first of all, of course, there is Dick Cheney, who was until the end of last year the president of Halliburton, which is a company that provides services for the oil industry. Condoleezza Rice was manager of Chevron between 1991 and 2000.
She's got an oil tanker named after her.
That's right. Ministers of Commerce and Energy, Evans and Abraham, worked for Tom Brown, another oil services giant corporation. So just those individuals alone provide quite a roster of oil expertise and interest within the cabinet. Of course, George W. Bush himself was a failed oil man, and his father, in addition to being a lifelong spook for the CIA and later vice president and president, was also an oil man.
Richard Bonney Faulkner, many think that we were on the verge of a global recession before September 11th. Now, with this rollover approaching within the next 8 years, etc., and the war in Central Asia, how do you see this affecting the economy?
Well, it's very treacherous making predictions about the economy. It appears that the current recession could be relatively brief, or it could be much deeper than many observers think so far. It's very hard to say. What can be said with certainty is that once the rollover actually arrives, then the global economy will be on a downhill trend more or less permanently because, as I said earlier, all economic activity is tied to energy. After that point, we may actually see even then some peaks and valleys. The economy will tank for a while, and then it'll attempt to rebound. And as of course it rebounds, the demand for energy will increase. And then as soon as demand once again exceeds supply, then the economy will then go on another downturn. So we could see several of those peaks and valleys before the sort of final plunge sets in.
Richard, after the September 11th attacks, George W. Bush said, quote, "I see this as an opportunity," unquote. In your opinion, what opportunity or opportunities did Bush see in this tragic event?
Yeah, that was a chilling statement. I remember sitting and listening to him say that as I was listening to the radio, and a chill went down my spine because I could immediately see that that this is, in fact, and it has proven to be, a tremendous opportunity for him. It's, first of all, given him political cover. Up until September 11th, his credibility as president was still very much in question. The legitimacy of the election that brought him to power, many people still question, but since September 11th, those questions have been drowned out. Even the survey by several major media outlets of the election itself was, when it was reported, even though that survey showed that if all of Florida had been counted, Gore would have won the election. When that was reported, it was skewed in such a way as to make it appear that Bush had won. And the reason this was done was because these media outlets, in the climate of the current war, were unwilling to seem unpatriotic by questioning the credibility or the legitimacy of Bush. Another reason that I think this is an incredible opportunity for him is the war is expanding the U.S. influence in Central Asia, and this can only be advantageous for Bush's oil cronies. A third reason is that it gives him a kind of stick to wield against his political enemies, and by this I mean not just Democrats, but also the anti-corporate globalization movement, which has been growing since November 1999 with a protest in Seattle. Every time the WTO or World Bank or any of these globalist organizations meet nowadays, there are huge protests, huge and growing protests. Well, since September 11th, all of that has changed. Opposition to increased military spending has evaporated since that time. And then folks at the National Security Agency, the CIA, the FBI, Secret Service, and now the new Office of Homeland Security all have something to be happy about, and that they've been promised funding and also legal powers that they could only dream of up until September 11th. So not only George Bush, but also the people around him have a tremendous amount to gain by these recent tragic events.
I'm Kelly Oramaris with Bonnie Faulkner, and we're talking to Professor Richard Heinberg about oil, war, and terror.
Richard, do you think that the United States government's now move into Central Asia, and by that, of course, I'm talking about Afghanistan at this point, although mm-hmm. they're certainly talking about expanding this bombing to, right. to many countries. They're talking about Asia proper, the Far East. Do you think that without this move into Central Asia, that a regional cooperative alliance could have formed in Central Asia that would have built a pipeline to China, for instance, rather than toward the West?
Right. Well, that was very much in the works. There had been talks even just a few weeks before September 11th between China, Russia, and some of the former Soviet republics about building exactly that kind of pipeline. There are and always have been several pipeline routes possible from the Caspian Sea to running north, west, east, and south. And, of course, the U.S. has favored the southern route going from Kazakhstan through Uzbekistan and Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean. And even in 1998, the Unocal Corporation Vice President for International Relations, John Maresca, was testifying before Congress on the importance of the region, and he said the Caspian region contains tremendous untapped hydrocarbon reserves, proven natural gas reserves within Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan equal more than 236 trillion cubic feet. The region's oil reserves may reach more than 60 billion barrels of oil, enough to service Europe's oil needs for 11 years. He also said that the Taliban government in Afghanistan was serving as an obstacle to the exploitation of these energy riches. So beginning already back in 1997, 1998, we see the beginnings of a tremendous amount of competition for these fossil fuel riches under the Caspian Sea between Russia, China, Europe to some extent, and the United States. And again, this Afghan war has really tipped the scales very dramatically in favor of U.S. influence in that region.
Richard, I understand that Russia has the second largest oil reserves in the world. Do you think it's possible that the U.S. government could be contemplating a move into Russia proper? Is that too far-fetched?
Again, that question requires a crystal ball. I think the U.S. would prefer to have a friendly government in Russia that it could manipulate in various ways, which I think has been the case for the last 10 years. To basically loot Russia's economy and Russia's natural resources, which include more than oil, natural gas, and minerals as well, without having to undertake a very costly and problematic military option. I think the U.S. undertook the military option in Afghanistan because essentially all the other options had proven futile. The Taliban had proven unwilling to cooperate with U.S. corporations, and essentially the U.S. ran out of patience with them.
One of the things that people have talked to us about Russia was that what we really want is the balkanization of Russia, that we don't want Russia to cooperate with its former Soviet republics in terms of exploiting oil.
Right. This is the tactic that has been used repeatedly over the past few years by the U.S. The balkanization of whatever country or region seems to be in our way. of course, the word Balkanization can't help but refer back to the region of Yugoslavia, where this tactic was used most recently. And it's interesting to note that 1 year after NATO stopped bombing in Yugoslavia, a pipeline has begun to be built from Bulgaria and Macedonia through Albania, pipeline linking Bulgaria's Black Sea port of Burgas with Albania's Adriatic port of Mura. And this pipeline will have a daily output of about 750,000 barrels of crude oil. Now, whether this building this pipeline was somehow a political goal of the actual NATO bombing is a question we'll never know the answer to, probably. But it's one of those historical situations where you see certain benefits coming to very powerful people as a result of actions they've taken. And one has to wonder whether those actions were, in fact, motivated by the potential of gaining that benefit.
It's my understanding that this proposed pipeline from Central Asia into Southeast Europe, as far as the physical assets are concerned, they're supposed to benefit Western Europe rather than the United States directly.
That's right.
So why do we have our fingers in that pie? Who's benefiting on our side?
Well, of course, the U.S. oil companies benefit, but also to the extent that U.S. has a strategic control of a region, then it's certainly in U.S. interest. Yeah.
Professor Heinberg, you give a lecture called Oil, War, and Terror. What is the relationship between oil, war, and terror for you?
The relationship between oil and war goes back to, really, the First World War. Ever since that time, wars have been fought over oil and fought with oil. In the First World War, the advent of tanks, trucks, and airplanes as instruments of war transformed warfare for the 20th century. In World War II, the objectives of both Japan and Germany were access to oil. Really, the reason that war erupted between the U.S. and Japan was Roosevelt's cutting off of oil supplies to Japan. And Japan had been importing over 90% of its oil from the U.S. as of 1940. Hitler was, of course, looking for sources of oil in Russia and northern Africa, and the fact that he was denied those sources meant that the Nazi war machine effectively ran out of gas, and that was more than anything else probably the reason that Germany lost the war. Since that time, again and again, war and terror have converged in places where oil deposits have been in dispute in one way or another, and we're seeing that playing out not only in Central Asia now and the Middle East, but also in Colombia, where Plan Colombia, which is part of the so-called drug war, is also very much about control of oil supplies in that country. So the situation that we see now where the Bin Laden family, the Bush family, Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, all enmeshed in oil, war, and terrorism, this is not a unique confluence of factors. We've seen the same thing playing out in various ways over a number of years. What we're seeing now, I think, is a kind of crescendo of that effect. One factor that I think needs to be brought into the discussion is the Saudi Arabian connection. From the U.S. perspective, this current war may be mostly about oil and natural gas in Central Asia, but from Osama bin Laden's perspective, it's all about Saudi Arabia. Starting in 1998, the Saudi monarchy decided for strategic reasons to globalize their economy, starting with the oil sector. They ratified new investment laws that allowed foreign businesses to own land in Saudi Arabia. Now, this enraged Islamic fundamentalists in Saudi Arabia, and certainly bin Laden and his associates. In May of 2001, ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, and eight other companies, including Conoco and Enron from the U.S., began a $25 billion natural gas development project in Saudi Arabia. So by the summer of this year, the Saudi monarchy had really invested itself in this new effort at globalization. And the purpose of this probably was to undermine the opposition within the country. The population of Saudi Arabia is growing rapidly. Despite Saudi Arabia's immense oil wealth, the per capita income is shrinking sharply. Over the past 20 years, it's shrunk by about half. And so the Saudi monarchy is facing tremendous domestic unrest. So I believe, and many others do, that the king of Saudi Arabia and his circle thought that by globalizing their petroleum resources, they could win the full backing of the U.S. and the European union in maintaining their grip on power. The timing of this, of course, is fateful because only a few months later we see the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York, 15 of the 19 hijackers being Saudi Arabians. So this whole series of events is a confluence of events not just in Central Asia but also in the Middle East, and it also has to do with the whole thrust toward the globalized economy that's been occurring over the past 20 years.
What relationship does Osama bin Laden have to petroleum, war, and the construction of oil pipelines in Central Asia?
Osama bin Laden is a member of a large and extremely wealthy Saudi family, one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia. And the bin Laden family business is a construction firm that specializes in oil pipeline projects, similar oil-centered construction projects. Osama bin Laden grew up in this context, and he knows the oil business very well. Interestingly, the bin Laden family have invested a great deal of their wealth in an investment firm called the Carlyle Group, which is an investment consortium centered on defense industries. The Carlyle Group buys and sells defense contractors. And so one of the officers, by the way, in the Carlyle Group is George Bush's father, the first President Bush, along with John Major, former Prime Minister of Great Britain, and a number of other dignitaries and former heads of state. So the Carlyle Group is a very, very powerful investment group, as you can imagine, with a roster of people like that at the helm, have a great deal of bargaining power in getting defense contracts for their companies. Post 9/11, of course, this relationship between the bin Laden family and the Bush family became a political liability for both, and the bin Laden family were more or less forced to disengage themselves from the Carlyle Group. There have been public expressions by the bin Laden family that they have disowned Osama bin Laden. He's no longer a welcome part of the family. It's impossible to either to verify or to disprove that assertion with what we know, but I think it's pretty safe to say that he's proven an extreme embarrassment to the rest of the family and political liability.
It would seem the fundamentalists are aware that globalization, when what's being globalized is an extractive resource, ends up with the resource being taken away from the country. You have some nationalism going on here?
Yes, of course. There are people in most of these oil-rich countries who would like very much to see their own nation, their own countrymen, benefit from these resources rather than seeing the wealth flow to a few elites in Western nations. This is certainly true in countries like Nigeria, where Chevron and Shell and other giant petroleum companies not only pump the oil out of Nigeria, but also pump out the profits and leave the native peoples there impoverished and with huge environmental disasters to cope with. What we're likely to see over the coming decades are increasing resource wars that will take various forms. Wars by the primary powers, U.S. and European powers, against uprisings in countries like Central Asian countries or African countries or South American countries, where indigenous people are trying to either save some of their land from exploitation or trying to divert some of the profits from that exploitation to their own economies. We're also likely to see more civil wars in these countries as puppet regimes installed to facilitate that kind of profit extraction are opposed by people within their own countries who want to see wealth more evenly distributed. This is discussed, by the way, very cogently, I think, by Michael Clare in his new book, Resource Wars, The New Landscape of Global Conflict.
Let's just once again redefine what the great rollover is.
Right. The coming peak in global oil production, which is, again, probably likely to occur between 2003 and 2010, after which there will probably be a few percentage points less oil available each year, no matter how many wells are drilled, no matter how much exploration is undertaken. Kind of a strange thing. This information is being hidden in plain sight. A number of national magazines, including Discover, the science magazine from Time Life, or Time Warner, I guess now, or Popular Science, Oil and Gas Journal, Scientific American, have all run articles or at least paragraphs mentioning the rollover, mentioning the looming oil shortage. But it's never really explored. The implications are not developed for people, and so I think we're all going to be taken very much by surprise by this when it finally does happen. And in fact, it may only be obvious in retrospect. It may be 5 or 10 years down the line before economists and historians are able to look at production figures and say, well, back in 2003, that was the peak in production, and it's been going down ever since then, and the economy's been in the tank ever since then. Why didn't someone tell us that? Why didn't someone say that it was about to happen? And they'll look back in Scientific American in 1998 and see that, in fact, there was an article on the subject or whatever. But, of course, our leaders, economic and political leaders, are withholding the information from us because they don't want us to hear bad news. Nobody ever gets elected by telling constituents bad news. So it's left up to, I guess, people like me to be the bringers of the bad tidings. Since I'm not elected to anything, I guess I can afford to mention the unmentionable.
And what's your picture of the final plunge?
Well, the parts of our economy that are dependent on fossil fuels, most notably transportation and especially air transportation, are unlikely to be able to make the transition to a non-fossil fuel economy. We hear about possibility of hybrid cars and hydrogen cars and so on. But the fact is, once we enter an energy-poor environment, it's just not going to be possible for us to make cars for every person, as is the case now. In a typical automobile, it takes more energy to manufacture the automobile than the automobile is actually going to burn in terms of gasoline during its lifetime. So in that kind of energy-poor environment, essentially we'll be looking at a mirror image of the kind of ramp-up to industrial globalization that we've seen over the past century. In other words, all forms of economic activity that emphasize small-scale, human power, local production for local consumption will be advantaged. People who are interested in organic farming and buying locally and so on, I think we'll be in a much better position than folks who are accustomed to buying products made halfway around the world and propping their lifestyle up with heavy indebtedness and lavish use of energy resources.
With the right wing putting together its agenda for fewer civil liberties, for people disappearing off the streets of America, do you think, I know it's hard to predict out, but do you think that part of this may be that they see this rollover coming? They see that someday, within a lifetime or two, people are going to be fighting over energy resources, and they are now instituting a program of strict social control to avoid violence in the future of low energy.
Yeah. Well, the question requires some speculation because I don't know really what's going on in the minds of Bush, Cheney et al., but my guess is that that's exactly right. I believe that when the economy does go into steep and permanent decline as a result of the oil rollover, the most likely result of that will be profound social unrest, not only here but throughout the world. And the hope of the power elites at that point will be to try to control that unrest as much as possible, to increase economic disparity as much as possible so that there, whatever oil-based riches are still left in the world are funneled to those who are already in privileged positions so that the pain and suffering from oil shortage is circumscribed. It's visited upon those who are already disadvantaged and poor. And that would be true not only globally, nation to nation, but also within the United States. And within that context of increasing economic disparity, it'll be necessary to have some means of social control to enable the elites to literally take any person or any group out of the picture that they desire without having to go through a great deal of legal maneuvering.
It would seem to me that it would also require some sort of mechanism to then re-harness the human labor that was replaced by oil in the Industrial Revolution if we are going to have further production.
Right. Return to slave labor. It's a horrific thought, but it's certainly not beyond the realm of possibility.
Well, that's a very grim picture. I know you do a lot of writing about culture and society and the place of energy in society. What can we do to avoid this scenario?
There are a few things that could be done, and they would make literally all the difference in the world. First would be in the developed countries to scale back on oil consumption by every means possible, and that includes transitioning from an oil economy to an economy based on alternative energies as much as possible. That would require not only tremendous investments in research and development and implementation of alternative technologies like solar and wind and so on, but also a tremendous investment just in conservation, cutting back on total energy use. The second thing we need, which is equally important, is a realistic, cooperative, transparent international plan to deal with our energy future. We need to be acknowledging publicly what the situation is with regard to petroleum and the impending world oil shortage. And we need to deal with that in an international arena publicly and in a democratic fashion to find a way to share cooperatively what is left, oil resources, petroleum, fossil fuel resources, share what's left in a way that enables a transition not only nationally but globally to a different kind of energy environment. Also, I think it would be extremely helpful for the U.S. media and government to begin to tell the truth about what's going on with the war in Afghanistan and political circumstances surrounding it. There are a great many unanswered questions that actually aren't even being asked publicly.
Such as?
The evidence to suggest that the war was being planned, at least in general terms, several months before September 11th. Evidence to suggest that the response, the immediate response, was illogical and unusual in various ways. The fact that jet fighters were not scrambled to intercept the hijacked airliners when that's a standard operating procedure. Dick Cheney said a few days after the events that they hadn't been scrambled because the president was concerned about making this momentous decision about shooting down civilian airliners. Well, that's really confusing the issue because the standard operating procedure is not immediately to shoot down hijacked airliners, but first simply to intercept them. And there were, within 10 miles of New York City, jets on 24-hour alert, two squadrons of fighter jets on 24-hour alert, exactly for situations such as this. So why they were not scrambled is a question that's not being answered. If we accept the standard press reports, the events of September 11th were the most catastrophic failure of the intelligence community in U.S. history, and yet we haven't seen any heads roll because of this, and there hasn't been any public criticism of the intelligence community. Instead, there have been simply calls for more funding of the CIA, NSA, and other intelligence agencies. This seems illogical at best.
And we also noticed that they have gone from knowing nothing right before, allegedly, to being able to identify all these hijackers, their names, their faces in the paper just a few days later. That seems suspicious as well.
Right. Well, I'm sure that many of the suspicions that you and I and others share are probably unfounded, but given the atmosphere, context of secrecy and unwillingness of the media to ask questions like these and unwillingness of the government to step up and answer them, openly share what information it has, that only leads to increased suspicion. And one can only hope that efforts on the part of investigative journalists and ordinary people just raising their voices will lead to breaking open this whole question.
Bonnie Faulkner. Richard, you have just talked about three major things that need to happen to help us get through this upcoming global chaos, if you will. To lessen our dependence on fossil fuels, to come up with an international plan to deal with the energy crisis, the looming energy crisis, and thirdly, for the media to start telling the truth about things.
Right.
Well, what sticks out in my mind is that none of these things are happening, and exactly the opposite is happening. It's as if the oil companies have a tighter grip on the government than ever. Oil is cheaper than ever. People are driving SUVs. The media is certainly not telling the truth. The United Nations doesn't seem to be effective at this point at all. What are we going to do? I mean, obviously, the problem is political.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. I think we have to be thankful for what free and open media sources we still have, such as KPFA. For the time being, the Internet is still uncensored. I have many friends who tell me that it would be impossible for the Internet ever to be censored. I'm not so sure of that myself, but for the time being, it is a free and open source of information. I think it's extremely helpful to follow alternative sources on the Internet like Alternet or ZMag.org. Also to follow foreign news. British newspapers like The Guardian and The Independent are accessible through their websites, and typically their news reporting is much superior to what we read in American newspapers or hear over broadcast sources.
Well, one of the problems is that our media is owned by the defense contractors and the energy people, right? GE owns NBC,
right.
Things like that.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. And the anti-globalization movement, or the global justice movement, as I prefer to call it, is really our greatest hope at this point. And I think we need to, rather than shrinking back after the events of 9/11, we perhaps need to change tactics, but I think it's more important than ever that people have the courage to openly, publicly challenge these global structures of corporate domination in any ways they can, whether it's writing letters, talking to friends, or turning out for demonstrations.
Do you think people are going to be more afraid than ever to speak out?
Well, I think that's the purpose of much of the recent anti-terrorism legislation. A large part of that was geared toward domestic terrorism, and if you read some of the provisions of that legislation, it really seems to be designed to be used against the global justice movement in various ways. But again, if we allow ourselves to be terrorized by these actions of the government, then I think there really is no alternative for our children and our children's children. We will be forced to live out the kind of nightmarish situation that I was describing earlier. The only hope is that the people of this country, of this world, can gain access to the levers of power in some fashion and create that kind of international plan, international discussion about dealing with our energy future.
Vice President Dick Cheney in March of this year claimed that nuclear power was the answer to global warming because nuke plants did not produce greenhouse gases. Now, we haven't been hearing much about that since September 11th, since one can picture that airliner that crashed into the World Trade Center going into, let's say, the Indian Point power plant instead, and we should thank our lucky stars that didn't happen.
Right.
But where do you see the pro-nuclear people in this?
There are certainly many people who are proposing new designs of nuclear plants that they say would be much safer. I and many other people who are interested in the energy future are very much against the nuclear option for so many reasons. The first is simply pragmatic. People who get very far into energy discussions inevitably end up doing what's called energy cost analysis. And by cost, I don't mean dollar cost, but energy cost. Energy return on energy investment. How much energy does it cost to produce, say, a barrel of oil? Or how much energy does it cost to produce, say, a solar photovoltaic panel? Well, when we do energy analyses of nuclear plants, they always come out negative. It costs more energy to make a nuclear power plant and to decommission it and to store the radioactive waste for thousands of years than could ever be retrieved from the nuclear plant itself. So nuclear energy has been a loser from the beginning in energy terms, so it makes absolutely no sense for us to be investing in nuclear power at this point from a purely pragmatic standpoint. Then, of course, there are the political implications of nuclear power. The fact that nuclear fuel for weapons is produced at nuclear power plants, and of course that was the prime motive for introducing Atoms for Peace in the first place back in the 1950s. And then the fact that nuclear waste is produced, which then has to be protected and guarded for generations and generations. We're essentially forcing a way of life on our distant descendants, ensuring that they will have police and military armies of experts to guard all the nuclear waste that we're producing now that will still be around 10,000 years from now. It's an outrageous option from just a political standpoint as well as a practical standpoint. So I, for one, see no future in the nuclear option.
Do you ever have a sense, I know I have this sense, that the power elites, the energy elites in the world today don't care what happens after the great rollover, don't care what happens further on down the line with fuel or the way societies will run on low energy?
Well, I think in their heart of hearts, these people probably do care, but they're in a situation where they see that the world has become addicted to this resource. we have spent the last 100 years ramping up production and consumption to the point where our entire lifestyle is completely dependent on the use of these fossil fuels, and they and all of their friends have become wealthy as part of that process. I'm sure they feel some pangs of regret or guilt that things didn't turn out differently, but here we are after all, and given the situation, what do we do? Where they are in that equation, with being sort of at the top of the economic pyramid, having not only wealth but also political power and influence as a result of where they are, I think it's understandable in human terms that they would want to preserve that wealth and power. It's understandable. That doesn't necessarily make it the best option from the standpoint of the rest of humankind.
You had just mentioned that nuclear is a loser in terms of the energy costs relative to what is produced to actually use as energy. Who's the winner in this comparison?
We have become accustomed to an energy bonanza in the form of oil and natural gas. When an oil well is still in its early producing phase, it can yield an energy return on investment of as much as 100 to 1 or even better. Whereas when we're talking about solar photovoltaics or wind or any of the alternative energies, we're looking more in the range of 1 to 1, 2 to 1, 5, 6, 8 to 1 energy return on investment. It's still worth doing, and it's possible to imagine a way of life where we wouldn't have to give up all of the benefits of civilization that we've become accustomed to. But certainly, we will, after the current generation, we will never again see a way of life that uses energy on the same basis that we've become accustomed to in the 20th century.
But there then, though, is the short-term disincentive. If you can still get a 100-to-1 return on oil, there's the incentive to drill in Anwar, to drill in the national parks, just to pick up that short-term return, isn't it?
That's right. As an environmentalist, I'm absolutely opposed to drilling in the Arctic and in Alaska. From a practical political standpoint, I think once the shortage is actually hit, it'll be very difficult to argue against drilling virtually anywhere on the planet. I hate to imagine what that will mean, but given our tremendous dependence on that resource, it's hard to imagine governments voluntarily giving up access to whatever reserves might possibly be left.
Well, let's then bring this back full circle, though, because you started by saying it was predicted in the 1950s that the U.S. would have the rollover in the 70s. That has been verified. Yet the economy, with some ups and downs, has been flying high. The price of gas is low. Some people would say, don't worry, be happy. How have we gotten away with this for a generation?
Right. Well, for the last generation, essentially the U.S. has gotten away with it by manipulating the global economy. The U.S. is still producing oil at a pretty good clip, even though we have to import over 40% of our oil. Nevertheless, we're still one of the world's foremost producers. And by maintaining the Saudi monarchy in power, we've been able to stay in their good graces and keep the price of oil and gas low. It's been a balancing act, and so far we've been able to run that balancing act successfully in our favor. How much longer that will be the case is very much in doubt, though.
But we're using war as a tool to keep it running.
That's exactly right. And the Central Asian former Soviet republics would appear to be the last large untapped reservoir of natural gas and oil. So I think we're likely to see more war and more political infighting in that area in the future, in the next few decades. George Bush said that Afghanistan is only the beginning of the war against terror. Well, I think he's right about part of that. Afghanistan is only the beginning, but what this war is really about is not necessarily terrorism at all. I think it's mostly about control of global resources.
And Cheney had said that this war might last beyond our lifetimes.
Right.
Of course, with him, you never know how long that's going to be.
Yeah.
In your article, Oil, War, and Terror, you start your article with a Saudi saying, "My father rode a camel, I drive a car, my son rides in a jet airplane, his son will ride a camel." Do you think that's going to be the case?
Well, yes, and I think the Saudis you know, through that saying are really articulating a real truism. It's true for them and it's true for us. We may not have camels, but just a couple of generations ago, most economies were locally based. Even at the beginning of the 20th century, most families were still farm families, or most production was for local consumption. And the 20th century was all about stretching that line between producer and consumer, adding more and more middle people and more geographical space. The 21st century is going to be about reducing that connection again, making production and consumption smaller scale, more local, and simpler. And we may not find ourselves riding camels, but our children and our children's children may well find themselves doing a lot more walking and bicycling, not only for the exercise, but also out of necessity.
It seems that we're going to have to make some choices as to what goes local and what remains global.
Hmm.
And that obviously food and farming looks like an obvious one to go local. I don't think we really want to let go of global communications.
Right.
Who's going to be making the decisions as to what goes where?
That's the big question right there. Who is going to be making the decisions and how? Without the information, it's impossible for the people to make those decisions, even if they are formally empowered politically to do so. We're facing a double crisis now, where not only are people being disempowered politically, because the political process itself is being short-circuited. We have a man in the White House who was not elected, after all. We forget that. And also, the information that people need to make those decisions is being withheld from them. And that starts with the information of the rollover itself and extends then to information about the real reasons for the current war in Central Asia. Even the fact that Bush has sealed the records of previous administrations, especially the Reagan previous Bush administration, that's a horrendous fact. If one, you know, studies democracy, what democracy is really about and how it functions, secrecy is the biggest enemy of democracy. Secrecy has no place in a democracy, and one can really tell pretty clearly the state of health of a democracy by just gauging how much secrecy there is. I think the Freedom of Information Act was a huge stride forward in our country, and of course it certainly didn't solve all problems as far as democracy is concerned, but it really enabled a tremendous amount of investigative journalism and public knowledge of what was going on in government. Unfortunately, I think we're seeing the end of that trend now and beginning of a trend back toward greater secrecy, and that has very ominous implications for the state of democracy in our country.
Richard, would you like to tell us about your newsletter, the Muse Letter, and how people might find that?
Sure. Yeah, the Muse Letter is a monthly 4,500-word essay that I write and send out to about 300 subscribers around the world. And it's a very free-form publication because it has no advertising, and no one's looking over my shoulder telling me what I can or can't write. So it's been in publication for over 10 years now, and listeners can find out about it by going to www.museletter.com.
We've been listening to Professor Richard Heinberg, New College of Santa Rosa, editor of the Muse Letter, on the subject of oil, war, and terror. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
The book Professor Heinberg recommended, Resource Wars, The New Landscape of Global Conflict, by Michael Clare, is published by Metropolitan Books, Henry Holt & Company. And L.B. Magoon's poster explaining the big rollover is available for download at www.oilcrisisoneword.com/Magoon, M-A-G-O-O-N.
That was Kelly Ramirez and Bonnie Faulkner speaking with Professor Richard Heinberg late last year. Next, we'll take a brief look at the situation in Colombia, a case study in the geopolitics of the New World Order. Gretchen King of CKUT in Montreal spoke with exiled Colombian human rights activist Manuel Rosenthal. Though the interview focuses on Canada's role, the United States has led the way in creating the situation that Rosenthal describes. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.